Daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Meeting his French counterpart Stéphane Séjourné in Beijing, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi says China is willing to work with France to build a more solid and dynamic bilateral relationship. Thousands of Israelis marched in Jerusalem over the weekend, calling for more efforts to free the hostages in Gaza and for early elections in the country. China's manufacturing sector has returned to expansion territory. Welcome to World Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi says China is willing to work with France to build a more solid and dynamic bilateral relationship. He made the remarks while meeting his French counterpart Stéphane Séjourné in Beijing. Wang Yi says China's development and opening up will provide more opportunities for France and other countries. The minister also says de-risking from China is against the interest of Europe. Séjourné says France is willing to enhance cooperation with China in sectors such as economy and trade, agriculture, green development, and artificial intelligence. He says France opposes decoupling and remains committed to handling differences through consultation. Séjourné is paying his first visit to China since taking office as a French foreign minister in January. Now, for more, we're joined by Professor Cui Hongjian from the Academy of Regional and Global Governance, Beijing Foreign Studies University. Thank you, Dr. Cui. It's good to have you back on the show.
Hi.
Now, Professor, in general, you must be following this. I mean, how do you see the tone of the remarks by the two foreign ministers during the press conference in Beijing?
This tone showed by this joint press by both two ministers. I think it's positive as possible. As we know now, not only the relations between China and Europe, and also especially the relations between Europe and the United States become a little bit more complicated. So especially now, for both countries, they need to try to find out some more common grounds to deal with every kind of challenges on bilateral and also multilateral level. So far, as we know, both China and France, they share the more and more consensus, not only on bilateral level and also on global level. So not only on economic and trade and also on strategic level. So we can find that more and more, consensus has been forged for this visit.
Mm.
So we do have some more reasons that for China-France relations, they do have some more, more prospective in future.
Mm. Well, in the press conference, Professor Cui, Wang Yi mentioned four aspects through which he suggested the two sides can work on to build China-France relations of strategic stability and vision. That's what he said. These four aspects are to lead international unity, to lead global innovation, to lead openness and win-win cooperation, and to lead dialogues among civilizations. Now, Professor Cui, why did he mention specifically these four aspects?
Among all of these four aspects mentioned by Minister Wang, we can find that not only emphasis of some principles for cooperation for bilateral relations between China and France, and also some solutions to current challenges for both two countries. For example, now we are looking at so many divisions and also oppositions in international relations. So now it's very, very necessary for some more solidarity, some more exchange, and also unity for all of the players. Another, I think, a very big issue is now we are in the process of technological innovation.
Mm.
We are facing some uncertainties from some new technology. So how to keep the balance between the innovation and also management and also regulation, it's indeed a bigger challenge for both two countries. And of course, women cooperation and dialogue among civilization, always a traditional principle to guide the relations between China and France. So not only some principles and also some very useful solutions to some current challenges. I think it shows the not only the position for both two countries and also for these efforts for both sides to provide some solutions for the global and also for international community.
Professor Sui, China and France established diplomatic relations in January of 1964. France was the first to establish formal relations with China among major Western countries. We often talk about the China-France spirit. I mean, what wisdom or experience can we draw from the establishment of formal relations between the two?
Always a traditional experience for both sides, especially France is one of the first Western countries to establish a diplomatic relations with China. Always give resources and the confidence for both two countries to develop their relations. As we know, not only because of the historic experience, the most important thing is we can learn something from history to help the current situation. If we look at the past, at that time, the world was facing also the challenge of division and opposition or even confrontation. Nowadays, we are facing similar challenges for some, especially people or opinion from the Western countries to regard China as a rival, as a threat or even a challenge. So I think now it's time for both China and France to recall this experience and the wisdom to refuse any kind of attraction to be block confrontations. We need to still have some more cooperation exchange and to deal with any challenges for us.
Well, France is a major ally of the United States in the increasingly competition between China and the United States, especially on the tech and economic front. I mean, Professor Sui, where does France stand and how much will France align itself with the, the de-risking strategy?
Certainly now there is a risk for what we call the bloc confrontations. Especially for United and its ally on one side and some other non-Western countries on the other side. But I think now, so far, France is trying to find its own position and not to be part of this bloc confrontations. Especially the last April, when President Macron finished his visit to China, he mentioned that it's unnecessary for France or even Europe to take the same side with the United States, especially how to find its own position as maybe the third power or the third player out of this bloc's confrontation will be in the interest of France and Europe. So I think that once France and Europe to continue this kind of thinking and also to have some more actions, certainly, France and Europe, they will have their own interest and they will have their own higher and higher, strategic importance to help the world to stop any kind of tendencies to be another kind of a new Cold War. I think on this regard, both China and France, we shared a lot of consensus. We will do our best to stop any kind of risks.
Now, Professor Sui, we have about 2.5 minutes to wrap up this conversation, but how is China handling its relations with France in this China-France-U.S. triangle?
I think, firstly, China always takes the venue of France as the independent player in the so-called Western bloc. And even we can find out between China and France, we do have a lot of potential to develop their cooperation in some traditional, sectors and also some new areas. And certainly, China also takes the importance of France as a leading role within the European Union. So not only on the bilateral level, China will continue its cooperation with France. And also China is looking forward to some more positive, though, from France to help the China-Europe relations. But of course, certainly, once there are some more cooperation exchange between China and France, there will not be more risk for this new Cold War. So I think this time, especially this year, there will be some more, positive event happen between those two countries and to help not only France and Europe interests and also the common interests between France and China, between Europe and China.
All right, that certainly is a hope. Thank you, Professor. That was Professor Cui Hongjian from the Academy of Regional and Global Governance at Beijing Foreign Studies University. We appreciate your time and insights. Coming up, thousands took to the street over the weekend in Israel, demanding more efforts to release hostages in Gaza and early elections in the country. You're listening to World Today. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. We'll be right back after a short break.
Hello, my name is Alessandro Golombievski Teixeira. I'm a professor of public policy and management at Tsinghua University in Beijing. I am a great listener of The World Today. In my opinion, The World Today is one of the best China radio programs. In The World Today, we can get the best news and analysis in what is happening now in the world. So please, come to join us.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Thousands of Israelis have marched in Jerusalem, calling for more efforts to free the hostages in Gaza and for early elections in the country. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the nation and said the military was preparing to launch an attack on Rafah, a refuge for over 1 million displaced Palestinians. Sam Mednick has more from Jerusalem.
Egypt state media said that ceasefire negotiations resumed in Cairo on Sunday. It's unclear if Hamas was there. It's also unclear what these talks were focused on. The situation is still developing. But Netanyahu has said that he has given his intelligence chiefs permission and approval to continue these discussions and has given them negotiating instructions. But there have been several rounds of talks already that have fallen through, and there are little hopes that these current talks are going to yield anything different. Netanyahu is, however, under increasing pressure back at home. Israelis are getting angrier and more frustrated of his handling of the hostage crisis, as well as his handling of the war. I was in Jerusalem, where tens of thousands of people were protesting outside the parliament. This was the largest anti-government protest since the war began. People were demanding that the hostages come home. They were also demanding that Netanyahu resign. I spoke to a man named Udi. He traveled from the southern city of Eilat for hours just to reach Jerusalem, saying that he wants Netanyahu out, even if that means so during the war, because he's had 6 months to turn things around and he has not done so. Netanyahu addressed the nation on Sunday. He said that he felt the pain of the families of the hostages, but he said that elections now would only paralyze the government for up to 8 months, and it would also paralyze these hostage talks. Also on Sunday, Netanyahu's office said that he was undergoing surgery for a hernia. The Justice Minister, Yariv Levin, is going to be the acting prime minister in his place until he comes back. Now, while this is happening, there are still attacks going on all across Gaza. The health ministry said that 77 people have been killed within the last 24 hours. And there are attacks continuing on hospitals. At least 2 people were killed, 15 injured, including journalists, in the compound of the Al-Aqsa Hospital. Israel said it was striking the Islamic militant group Islamic Jihad, that it hits them. They had a command center there, but it did not affect the hospital's ability to function. Israel's also into its second week of its raid on the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. It said that it found in the maternity ward on Sunday weapons that some were stashed underneath the mattress as well as inside walls. But hospital staff there say that the situation is inhumane. There's not enough water or medicine, and the World Health Organization has warned that there are only 10 minimally functioning hospitals now in all of Gaza, and thousands of people don't have access to health care.
That was Sam Mednick on the Israel-Palestine conflict. For more, I earlier talked to Dr. Tim Anderson. He is director of Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, a Sydney-based think tank. Thank you, Dr. Anderson, for talking to me. Now, these protesters are calling for a ceasefire deal with Hamas so that some Israeli hostages could be released. How do you assess the possibility that the Israeli government gets ahead with this?
Well, that really depends on the position of Netanyahu in the government at the moment. Remember, he heads a coalition government. He's become a very unpopular figure in the country. And there have been huge protests, the largest of which are happening now, as he just went to hospital and had an operation, which apparently he's passed through successfully. He was snubbed by the U.S. in a visit, but one of his ministers, Yoav Gallant, has just been in the U.S., being briefed by the U.S., and the U.S. has differences with Netanyahu. Netanyahu has pledged to take another offensive into the southern part of Gaza around the city of Rafah, and the U.S. has been advising him against it. So really, the protest is one of the main issues of the protesters' agenda is to do a deal to release the remaining hostages, because many of the hostages have been killed already. So that's a lot of large part of the tension with the protesters against Netanyahu at the moment. But it really depends on how this Israeli government hangs together now.
Mm. Well, another appeal of the protesters is an early election in Israel. I mean, what could be the possible political impact of such calls and, in general, the impact of the demonstrations?
Well, if there were an early election, Netanyahu would almost certainly lose. And indeed, the demonstrators have some backing for this from the U.S. side, because the U.S., members of the U.S. administration have made it very clear they see Netanyahu as an obstacle to progress in the region there. So on the other hand, on Netanyahu's side, if there is an election, if he loses office, he'll be going to jail because he has major corruption charges against him. And part of the agenda of the demonstrators is also to try and derail the agenda he has to place the judiciary under control of the executive there. So it's a more or less a political survival game for Netanyahu. If he survives, he may go ahead with this rougher offensive. On the other hand, he's alienating seriously his U.S. backers at the moment.
Mm. Well, Netanyahu has responded to the protesters' appeals. In a press conference, he hit back at the protesters' calls for an early election, saying only Hamas would benefit from this. He also said he was doing all he can to secure the release of the hostages. Now, moving forward, how do you think him and also his coalition government, you know, will proceed with, you know, big decisions like the early election, the release of a ceasefire deal with Hamas?
Well, on the early election, I think really if Netanyahu has the final say in it, it will not happen, basically, because it's going to play into the hands of an alternative coalition, basically. Mm. In terms of Hamas, of course, blaming Hamas for everything is par for the course for Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders at the moment. The problem is that the demonstrators also blame Netanyahu for October the 7th. They say that under Netanyahu, who had this reputation as being a strong man trying to control and repress the Palestinians, they had the largest uprising against Israeli rule, you know, in modern history, basically, with October the 7th, where a large part of the Gaza division of the Israeli military was destroyed and the intelligence was surprised. So they blame Netanyahu for October the 7th, as well as for not paying enough attention to the hostages and going ahead with his war. And of course, the consequences being they don't think the hostages are going to survive if Netanyahu orders the army into Rafah.
Mm. Well, about Rafah, Israel has insisted that it will move ahead with the plan. The United States, on the one hand, said it has pressed Israel not to go ahead with the Rafah attack. On the other hand, it has just approved a new pile of jazz bombs and so on to Israel. So how do you see this role of the United States in the process?
Well, that's right. That's the important contradiction, really. The Israeli military has been proceeding with its slaughter in Gaza only because it has the backing politically, diplomatically and militarily with weapons and money from the U.S., basically, from some other states, but mainly from the U.S. So the U.S. is responsible for this. At the same time, they've talked about trying to have some influence on deferring this attack on Rafah. It's a test of the U.S. influence, really, in the region, that if they're providing money and weapons to this regime, why can't they influence what it's doing? We know that there are many in the U.S. administration that want him to defer that, but it's not clear to what extent they're going to have influence there, unless there were a change in regime in Israel itself, which is possible because of the demonstrations have been ramping up. There's significant differences within the government itself and certainly within the military. I think there are dissidents within the military that are concerned about how their image is going to plummet if they engage in further massacres of civilians in Rafah there, which Netanyahu, of course, wants to do.
Mm. Well, a few days ago, U.S. voted in abstention when the U.N. Security Council passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Has the U.S. done enough in terms of its leadership role within the U.N. system for the purpose of bringing peace to Gaza?
In my opinion, clearly it has not. Even after abstaining on that resolution, in other words, they didn't play a constructive role there. Even Britain supported the resolution, for example. Even after abstaining, the Washington administration started to say this is non-binding, it doesn't really matter, the Israelis can do what they want. And that's not really imprinting any sort of U.S. leadership on this role. And the U.S., of course, has the most influence. They could stop the operation in Gaza today if they wanted to. That's been pointed out on many occasions. So I think the deficiency of the U.S. and its complicity in the slaughter that's been going on in Gaza. Remember, this is also subject to an International Court of Justice proceeding at the moment, which has also weighed in recently talking about the issue of providing aid and food to Gaza, because famine is likely to be a large cause of death in the very near future too. So the U.S. responsibility for this is not going to look good historically, looking at back at what they've done and what they haven't done.
Mm. Dr. Anderson, the Palestinian Authority has just announced the formation of a new cabinet. I'm sure you have been following this. So how do you see the new lineup and its future role in bringing peace to the region?
It's not very relevant, really, because the Palestinian Authority itself is extremely unpopular. They haven't had elections for 18 years. They don't have much influence. They're not really involved, for example, in the ceasefire talks in Qatar or in Egypt. It's really the Palestinian resistance factions and the Fatah party, which dominates the PLO and the Palestinian Authority, only have one small fraction of those resistance. In other words, the people who are actually fighting the Israeli invasion in Gaza. It's a coalition led by Hamas. So those resistance groups really have to be part of any Palestinian Authority that has any credibility and influence within Palestinian society. Of course, the Israelis don't want to see that. The U.S. doesn't want to see it either. So the restructuring of the Palestinian Authority to create what the U.S. had demanded really was they wanted what they called a technocratic, in other words, a depoliticized political leadership in the Palestinian Authority. In other words, they wanted really a puppet administration, which is the way a lot of Palestinians see the authority. So I'm afraid this new cabinet is not going to make a lot of difference, because the Palestinian Authority itself does not have much authority within Palestinian society these days.
Mm. One more question, Dr. Anderson. You earlier mentioned Qatar. Which other regional powers should play more active roles in this?
Well, Egypt has been a site of the talks, but I mentioned Qatar and Egypt because they are seen as really relatively neutral, at least having links with both sides. You know, you find most of the other Arab governments, of course, are very anti-Israel, and so they're a base for supporting the resistance groups rather than for the talks. But in terms of the peace talks, Qatar has links to Hamas. It also has a huge U.S. air base. So it's, for that reason, it's seen as having links with both sides, and that's why it's being used. I think in the longer run, of course, Iran is the major supporter of the Palestinian resistance groups. It helps finance and arm the resistance groups, and sections of Iraq and Lebanon, as well as Syria, also support the resistance groups in Palestine there. So in a sense, they don't have much diplomatic weight in terms of influencing the Israelis, but they have important weight in influencing and supporting the Palestinian resistance.
That was Dr. T.M. Anderson, Director of Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, a Sydney-based think tank. Coming up, China's manufacturing sector has returned to expansion territory. You're listening to World Today. For more discussions, you can follow us on the X platform at CGTN Radio. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. We'll be right back after a short break.
Welcome. I'm Ilaf Ellard, economics professor and member of the Data Science and AI Center at New York University, Shanghai. On the World Today program, you can find in-depth and impartial insight, as well as critical commentary on key trends in the Chinese economy, financial technology, business, and blockchain. To prepare for the world tomorrow, join me on World Today.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. China's manufacturing sector has returned to expansion territory. Official data show the Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, for China's manufacturing sector came in at 50.8 in March. The 50-point mark separates growth from contraction. The positive rebound followed five consecutive months of sub-50 readings that started in October. The upbeat results followed recent better-than-expected export and retail sales data. Expansion in manufacturers' output and new orders also accelerated last month. For more on this, we're joined by Qu Qiang. He is fellow of the Belt and Road Research Center at Minzu University of China. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you.
Now, first up, help us understand this Purchasing Managers Index for China's manufacturing sector. What does it really entail?
Well, everybody understands what is PMI, right? PMI is a very important indicator showing the expansion and the shrinking of our productions in the national economic activities. So we're looking at there are more than 1.7 of the percentage in the PMI rise, more than the previous 2 months in China, which shows after the 2 months of the Spring Festival season and the opening month, actually the March, since the March, Chinese economy are facing a very solid and quickly rebound. And actually, it shows a very good sign for the rest of the year, because everybody knows that 2024, China set the GDP growth ratio target is 4.5%. So I think with this good number and the performance of our economy, we can see confidently see an expansion in our economy, not only in the manufacturing, but also in the service sector. So I think 5% of the GDP target could be, you know, a very sure bet.
Mm. Well, this 50.8 actually came in after, you know, five consecutive months of sub-50 readings. I mean, what factors, in your opinion, have contributed to this, you know, this expansion in China that have resulted in this recent rebound?
Well, I think this rebound actually comes from several sectors. Well, first of all, let's talk about the short term. Everybody knows in a short term impact, January and February are usually, you know, historically the slow months of the year, because everybody knows China, we have the long Spring Festival holidays. So every year, usually in the first 2 months of the year, Chinese factories stop to receive orders, and the delivery of service and products will also slow down. And the banking sectors will always try to clear up the taps of the last year and also try to calculate the taps of the or the loans of the next year. So it's more like a clearing period of time. So, you know, if you're familiar with Chinese companies' operation, you want to know every fiscal year of the Chinese company, not starting from the January, but most of the companies starting their, you know, fiscal year counting starting from the March. So
right.
When we enter the March, so everything, you know, come back to the normal rhythm. So compared to the last 2 months, we see a very quickly rebound, that's for sure. And also there's another factor is very important as the overseas factors. We've been taking a look at the United States, Japan, and also as the ASEAN nations. We've been finding the Chinese order, especially in the export, are growing really fast, not only to the United States, European Union, but also very quickly to the Vietnam and the other emerging markets. So it shows that probably the whole globe are encountering a, you know, what we call the end of the inventory cycle, which means, you know, my inventory has already been running out. So I need to replenish with the new supplies, new products and services to, you know, cope with the coming, you know, Q2 of the 2024. So I think that's two factors overlapping together contribute to this fast growth of the last PMI numbers.
Mm. Well, we are still in quarter one, as you have said. What remain the challenges for the manufacturing industry in China moving ahead?
Well, I think generally for the very tradable sectors in China, for example, if you take a look at the breaking down numbers and the categories of the PMI, you find out that the furniture, electronics, computer-related or internet-related products, and also the transportation-related products like EV, like the ships, vessels, and the parts are growing really fast. It shows that the globalization and global trade are, you know, growing back and recovering very quickly. But also the challenges lying ahead of us, we're not sure what the global supply chain is going to look like. Just take a look at the Yemen region. Take a look at the Middle Eastern region. Take a look at the Eastern Europe region. We've been seeing the supply chain are still very much disrupted. The food prices are still very high. And also we've been seeing that, the oil prices are still very high. So we're not sure how these factors are going to contribute to, you know, the future factors. And also, taking a look at China itself, breaking down the numbers, you see the real estate market or housing market related industries like construction, like the iron and steels, are still in a slow motion. So can we just gain back the confidence and people's expectation in the housing market so we can, you know, find, you know, very stable return in this year's, you know, economic growth? I think there remains questions. But let's just cross fingers and hope the best of it.
We're talking about the external environment, as you mentioned, the uncertainties in the supply chain globally. Has the Chinese government done enough, you know, to prevent, the Chinese economy from sliding into those challenges and risks?
Yes, I think the government of China and also the business society of China are, you know, very much, you know, having prepared their minds as well as their capacities, you know, to, you know, embrace the impact of the global uncertainty. For example, in China, we have issued, I don't know, from the top-notch, design, we have already designed like 24, policies to welcome foreign investors and enterprises coming into China. So the logic here is if the whole society, you know, if the whole global society is still in, you know, this geopolitical conflicts, uncertainties, so just stay away from the troubles. Move the supply chain, move the capacity into China, where this is the safe, peaceful, and stay far away from all the troubles. So we can make sure that global supply chain, the supply side can be, you know, stabilized. And also towards the global, you know, supply chain, especially in the transportation side, you know, Chinese vessels, Chinese ships, are, you know, one of the very few countries, you know, capacities are not so much being impacted from the international geopolitical conflict. Chinese vessels can still, you know, travel very safely through the Red Sea and Yemen, you know, sea channel. And also Chinese products are still being and guaranteeing the supply chain in many regions in the Europe, in Latin America, in Africa. And also, if you take a look at the Chinese ship-making industry, their order probably are going beyond their capacity, which means, you know, Chinese ship-making industry are making ships right now for the rest of the world. Make sure that, you know, when this all kinds of uncertainty comes, we still can have enough ships and vessels and also the other kind of vehicles to help the whole world to transport what we need in this supply chain, make the things on the move. So I think we're making our effort. And also we hope the rest of the world can also, you know, see this and also join us to stabilize the value chain of the whole, you know, global society.
Indeed. Always a pleasure to have you. Qu Qiang, fellow of the Belt and Road Research Center at Minzu University of China. This is World Today. Stay with us.
Hello, I am Dr. Digby James Wren, a political analyst and international relations scholar specializing in China area studies. World Today offers unmatched in-depth perspectives on China's politics, economics, business, technology, and society. World Today's team of reporters and contributors provides valuable information from all of the world's major economies. I hope you can join me on World Today for the very best insights and news from China, on China, and help to build a better understanding of China's role in the world today.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. China has strongly opposed the tightening of U.S. rules on semiconductor exports, saying they create more hurdles to trade and more uncertainty in the chip industry. The Biden administration last week revised rules aimed at making it harder for China to gain access to U.S. AI chips and chip-making tools. The revision came less than 6 months after the U.S. introduced the rule. The Chinese Ministry of Commerce said the move seriously affects mutually beneficial cooperation between Chinese and foreign enterprises and harms their legitimate rights and interests. Now, for more on this, Zhao Ying joins us in the studio. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Now, first up, the U.S. says these restrictions are about national security. How do you see that concern, and what do you think the U.S. is trying to achieve here?
Well, obviously, the so-called China chip threat theory has become a dominant narrative in U.S. media and political discourse. They have consistently framed these restrictive rules as necessary steps to safeguard what they call national security. However, I think it's important for us to take a closer look at the bigger picture surrounding these measures, because I think we are witnessing what some would describe as cognitive warfare, which has become a new frontier in international relations. It involves using various tactics, including spreading misinformation, to shape narratives and perceptions. And so I think the constant reiteration of the China threat creates a narrative of fear and suspicion as it paints China as a destabilizing force in global affairs. However, these accusations often lack concrete evidence and appear to be part of a larger strategy to maintain U.S. technological dominance. It was reported as early as 2021 that the U.S. National Security Commission concluded that the country could potentially lose its advantage in the semiconductor industry due to the rapid development of China's chip industry. And the co-chairman of the commission said the U.S. currently enjoys a two-generation lead over China in terms of semiconductor, but urgent actions is needed to prevent the loss of this edge. So I think perhaps the U.S. is abusing the concept of national security in order to maintain their hegemonic role in this sector.
Right. In specifics, the previous rules were introduced just last October. Why we're having the revision so soon?
Well, I guess one key factor is the fast-paced nature of this technology, because AI chips are constantly being developed and improved, and the U.S. may feel that the originally planned restrictions might not be effective enough in light of China's potential advancements. And also, they might feel the original rules need further clarification for practical enforcement. For instance, the revision provides more details on what technologies are restricted and how the limitations will be applied, like the new rules mention restrictions on laptops containing these AI chips. But more importantly, I think they want to send a message that they are staying vigilant and adapting their strategy as needed. Because according to some expert, actually the practical application of AI on laptops is primarily focused on gaming, graphics displays, and entertainment. However, the use of AI chips on laptops is not yet widespread, and large-scale application may not occur in the short term. So perhaps the restriction is just another way for U.S. politicians to demonstrate a tough stance on China, especially during the election period.
Now, in reality, Zhao Ying, how reliant is China on U.S. semiconductors, and how will China's chip industry be affected by the new rules?
Well, it turns out China is not as dependent on U.S. chips as the U.S. might think, because in fact, China's chip industry is pushing forward, and as it focuses on its own innovations and making strides in manufacturing its own semiconductors, like Huawei's Kirin 9000 is a very good example of a breakthrough against U.S. sanctions. And as we can see, Chinese companies are moving toward embracing domestic replacements and create a more self-sufficient ecosystem. And also, China's manufacturing capacity for semiconductors, especially for mature or lower-end chips, has greatly improved. So as a result, the U.S. is constantly adjusting its policy in response to China's changes. It said that more focus is likely to be put on restricting sales of semiconductors produced in the Chinese mainland, which may open a new chapter in Washington's chip war.
Well, we have about 2 minutes and a half to wrap up the conversation, Zhao Ying. Won't these restrictions hurt U.S. companies as well by, you know, limiting their access to the Chinese market?
Well, absolutely. They will have a significant implication for U.S. companies operating in the global semiconductor market because, as we know, China is a major player in the semiconductor industry, both as a consumer and a producer. And the U.S. companies rely on access to this market for revenue and growth opportunities. And furthermore, China's semiconductor industry is deeply integrated into the global supply chain. And so restrictions can create bottlenecks and delays impacting the production for U.S. companies. And also, I believe China's growing semiconductor capabilities actually present both challenges and opportunities for U.S. companies because competition spurs innovation and drives technological advancements in the industry as a whole. And moreover, by restricting exports to China, U.S. companies may limit their access to market insights originating from Chinese firms. And in fact, the tightened restriction comes as U.S. chip makers ramp up their efforts to retain the Chinese market. And for instance, during the China Development Forum in Beijing last month, CEOs from leading U.S. semiconductor companies like the AMD, Qualcomm, and Micron all visited China and expressed their commitment to the Chinese market and their willingness to pursue cooperation. And also, NVIDIA said in March that it is expanding collaboration with Chinese enterprises to provide an in-vehicle computing platform created for AI applications to Chinese companies, including BYD. So with tightened restrictions, American companies could lose their valuable business opportunities and suffer from the restrictive policies of the U.S. government.
Well, quite a complicated issue, but thank you. That was my colleague Zhao Ying on the latest U.S. Tightened rules on chip exports to China. This is World Today. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Einar Tangen, a political and economic analyst and senior fellow at the independent Taiher Institute. World Today is news without the hype and business commentary that is informed and up to date, presenting the facts and asking incisive questions. So, join us if you are someone who needs to know what is happening in China as it is happening.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Chinese tech giant Huawei says its profits more than doubled in 2023 as smartphone and auto businesses picked up. Huawei said it generated a profit of 87 billion yuan or 12 billion US dollars last year, more than double 2022's 35.6 billion yuan. The firm's cloud and smartphone businesses thrived in 2023 despite US sanctions. Those restrictions since 2019 have cut Huawei's access to U.S.-made components, forcing the company to diversify. Now, for more on this, my colleague Zhao Yang spoke with Andy Mok, a tech analyst and senior fellow at the Center for China and Globalization.
So, Andy, first, the Chinese telecom giant Huawei has reported its profits more than doubled last year. So what do you think is the biggest factors behind this dramatic turnaround of profits, and what are its main revenue or profit sources now?
Well, Zhaoyang, we have to look at Huawei in this way. Before the unfortunate events of several years ago, Huawei was an enormously successful company in China and all around the world. But of course, by being placed on the entity list by the United States in what many see as an unwarranted attack on a private company, and the U.S. is seen as taking actions that were without evidence and very, very arbitrary, this devastated Huawei's business. So one way we can understand its jump in recent profits is that it has adapted to and put these events behind it and now is on a sustainable growth trajectory looking forward. And it did this in a number of ways. First, of course, it pivoted to new business areas that were less vulnerable to American sanctions. At the same time, it redid its supply chain for existing products that were devastated by American sanctions by cleansing its supply chain of American components and technology. And it's really important to point out here that this is, while it was a short-term disaster, frankly, for Huawei that it's overcome, it is now turning into a long-term disaster for American companies that used to be suppliers to Huawei.
And a lot of people are asking, how has Huawei managed to drastically increase its profits by so much and brush off those sanctions?
One, it's entered new areas like cloud computing, focusing on the automotive sector, et cetera, that were sort of brand new business areas that have turned out to be growth areas and profitable growth areas for Huawei. It's also returning to its more traditional businesses, smartphones, et cetera, that were affected by American sanctions. Another aspect, I think, of what they did that allowed them to return to profitability was concentrating on the China market, which we all know is enormous, but also growing quickly and with consumers who are willing to pay for products that they are satisfied with, either from a technological perspective, from a features perspective, a design perspective.
And starting in 2019, as you mentioned, the U.S. government has been rolling out a slew of measures to curb the development of Huawei, including cutting off its access to the high-end computer chips and software. But still, we've seen that Huawei released its Mate 60 Pro, the high-end smartphone, last year, which means the company, you know, made a comeback in the smartphone market. So how did Huawei make it?
Well, you know, I think one way to understand this is that there's an old saying, necessity is the mother of invention. So Huawei, again, previously for years, if not decades, was a technology leader, a product leader in the smartphone space. And so it had acquired tremendous manufacturing capability, of course, but also engineering capability, research capabilities as well. And it also worked with important Chinese partners to circumvent the restriction on certain kinds of chips available to Huawei that traditionally were provided by companies like TSMC, Qualcomm, et cetera. So what Huawei was able to do would, again, I think, rely on its resourcefulness and its determination, as well as working with Chinese partners. And I think here what has also changed is that many, many companies, not just in China but around the world, have recognized the danger of exposure to American technology and American suppliers. And again, I think this is very unfortunate because it's widely recognized that everyone prospers when there can be fewer restrictions on trade and sharing of technology, but Chinese companies like Huawei are being forced to develop their own alternatives, and by all accounts, they seem to be succeeding very well, and in the long term, this is only going to hurt, I think, American technological competitiveness and the position of many of these American publicly listed tech companies.
And Huawei spent a lot in research and development. In the year 2023, it invested 165 billion yuan into R&D, accounting for almost a quarter of its annual revenue. So how do you assess the company's innovation capability, and how is its advancement of 5G?
Well, I think Huawei, even from the very beginning, was committed to advancing, moving up the technology value chain. And so, you know, this large investment in R&D as a percentage of revenue is nothing new. So this is, again, I think in some sense, what makes Huawei Huawei. And 5G, of course, is another area that Huawei has demonstrated leadership in. And again, this is more than just the ability to manufacture 5G networking equipment, which is actually just as important, if not more important, than the 5G phones that most consumers are familiar with. But Huawei really has been working in 5G for almost or maybe more than 10 years, because these new generations of technology, 2G to 3G, 3G to 4G, 4G to 5G, actually begin with many technical discussions internationally, globally, that, again, are invisible to consumers. And Huawei has long played a part, sending engineers to these discussion groups, making proposals, et cetera. So, again, you know, this percentage of revenue invested in R&D is nothing new, and I think it shows Huawei's commitment as a technology company, but also its vision for thinking long term in what are the technologies that will become quite important and are very important today.
And it is also really interesting when we take a look at what they are doing in the field of electric vehicles. It's in-car technology. And we've seen that the company's Intelligence Auto Solution business saw a revenue grow over, you know, 100% year-on-year last year. So could you tell us more about that?
Well, you know, I think this is one of the biggest changes commercially that we are witnessing, this transition from fossil fuel powered vehicles and internal combustion engine vehicles to renewable energy vehicles. So mostly electric vehicles in China as well as in other parts of the world. In parallel with this, we are also living through the transition to fully autonomous vehicles or autonomous driving, where we become passengers in AI or robots, control the vehicle we're in, whether that's a car, a bus, you know, maybe some other mode of transport. And Huawei, of course, is playing in this space because AI is another very, very important growth sector and is also a technological force that is having a very profound impact on people's lives, on societies, and even the relationship among countries. So Huawei, again, has staked out a position in this. It's developed some leading-edge chips for AI applications. So I think it's not a surprise that it would see an opportunity in this space and, again, bring its talented workforce, its enormous investment in R&D, its manufacturing design capabilities, its strategic relationships with many companies around the world as well to the mobility revolution that we're seeing.
Andy Monk with the Center for China and Globalization. That's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Thank you for staying with us. Bye for now.